Welcome to the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility, an ongoing inquiry into the origins and evolution of American government. The executive director of the Virtual Center is Dr. Bill O'Brien. He's also the host of this discussion. And here he is, Dr. Bill O'Brien.
Agnes, thank you very much, and welcome to a Tuesday edition of the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution and Civic Responsibility. As everyone knows, today is November 8th. Today is Election Day. And whatever you're thinking about the campaign, the one thing to know is it ends today. At least the advertising does. And I think, I'll be very honest with you, at least on the national level, over the last 24 hours, it seems to have hit me more than ever before that whoever wins this may regret it. Because a lot of the issues that have surfaced during this campaign do not end with the end of the campaign. And they're going to have to be dealt with. And I'm assuming that we're looking at a Hillary Clinton victory. I'm afraid to assume that too much because we really don't know. But the polls seem to be trending in that direction, and there's no other alternative than the polls. So if the polls are telling you one thing, if you don't have any reason to not agree with them, then it seems to me you have no choice but to agree with them, at least to the point, So anyway, the point is that it's over, and I just heard a number of people. I went to our Rotary meeting just before it came on the air today. And a number of people, fellow Rotarians, were making the comment and said, well, whatever happens, it's over. At least the campaign's over, the advertising's over, the name-calling on a regular basis is over. And so now the issues really begin, because I think one of the things that has become clear is that there are really, really serious substantive issues. We'll be dealing with a few of those today, I'm sure, here at the Virtual Center. Let me welcome you to this program on this election day. And let me begin, as we usually do, by sharing with you some of the basic information that will enable you to be in contact with us other than merely listening to these programs, to these broadcasts. If you'd like to get on the air and share your thoughts with our audience, I'm sure that they would love to hear it. I know that I would. Our phone number is area code 304-663-4676. 304-663-4676. If you'd like to share your thoughts, your ideas, concerns, whatever, with our listeners, but you're a little bit reluctant to go on the air yourself, then please feel free to give me the honor of doing it for you. If you send me an email, I'll do the very best I can to get your thoughts or your issues on the air, and I'll try to, as best I can, represent your concerns and your issues as they're revealed to me in the email. I'm not going to do any editorializing or anything. I'll just present your issues as best I can, and I will assume that they will be substantive, because I know they will be. And hopefully we'll get some reaction. Maybe I'll have some reaction. But the fact of the matter is, if you have these ideas, then chances are that our other listeners would benefit from hearing them. And so if you don't want to do it directly on the air yourself, then I'd be glad to do it for you. My email address is waobrien906@gmail.com. That's waobrien, O-B-R-I-E-N, 906@gmail.com. And then finally, I want to mention our Facebook page. I have been maintaining a separate Facebook page, a political Facebook page, for the ongoing campaign, which ends today. And you can get that by just get to that by just going to William A. O'Brien hyphen candidate for the West Virginia House. And that'll get you to that page. But we also have a virtual center page, and we've had that for some time. If you go to the search box on the homepage of Facebook and type in the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution, you will have access to our Facebook page. Yesterday, I put a link to a video. Actually, I put a couple, I believe. But one of them is a specific link to a video, which was an interview conducted by Katie Couric with Max Boot. Many of you are probably familiar with the name Max Boot. Max Boot is a foreign policy advisor, primarily focusing on military affairs. He has been an advisor for a number of Republican candidates in the past. He was military advisor, foreign policy advisor for Mitt Romney during his campaign, for John McCain, I'm trying to think. I think George Bush as well. But during this interview with Katie Couric, the issue of the campaign, the current presidential campaign, was the issue at hand. Max Boot made the comment that he was really disappointed in John McCain because of John McCain's willingness to go along with the other leaders of the Republican Party in agreeing to do everything he can do in the Senate to make it impossible for a President Hillary Clinton to make a nomination to the Supreme Court to fill the seat of Antonin Scalia. And Max Boot's position is that he feels that he knows John McCain well enough to know that this is really not the real John McCain, that this is a decision he has made for political reasons, and that it doesn't really reflect his real feeling and the sense and the concerns he has for the nation or the welfare of the nation. And he was very, very supportive of the fact that Mitt Romney has really come out strongly against Donald Trump. And the comment that the issue that really got me into the video was a comment by Max Boot that the Republican leaders who really know him, quote, know that he's nuts, unquote. And then he went through and elaborated on exactly what he meant, what he means by that, primarily in the area of foreign policy and military affairs. I thought it was a very telling, a very revealing video. So I posted it on our Facebook page yesterday, and I've gotten a couple of comments and a couple of likes on it. It's very, very revealing. Unfortunately, it comes at the 11th hour in the campaign, right the day before the election. But the fact of the matter is, it's very, very revealing because this is a man who knows. And I really believe that a lot of people would benefit from it and would appreciate the opportunity to see it. So if you go to our Facebook page, you can click on and watch this video. It's very, very informative. I hope that a number of the things that are on our Facebook page are informative as well. And that's really the purpose, is to try to generate discussion, generate reaction. In most cases, they are strongly opinionated. What I mean is, these are particular issues that I feel very strongly about, and I put them on there not necessarily to convince you of my particular position, but to raise it and give you the opportunity to agree, disagree, or partly agree, or whatever. The whole idea is to generate additional conversation. That's really the purpose of the page. So again, If you go to Facebook and in the search box type in the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution, you will have access to our Facebook page. There are a number of postings there. About yesterday's, well, first of all, I don't know that it's, well, it's really very helpful to talk about the election, since people are currently voting and there are no results yet. I've had an interesting day personally myself, because everybody I meet asks me how I think I'm doing and how I think it's going, and I don't have an absolute clue. More than that, I won't know till after the polls close, and here they close at 7:30 this evening. So it'll be at least 8 o'clock this evening before we get any results at all. And what friends are telling me is that the first results we get at 8 o'clock or a little bit after will be the absentee ballots and the early voters. And then the votes that are being cast today, we probably won't know anything about those until after 9 p.m. this evening. So, I personally have no inkling, no way of knowing. I'm psychologically trying to prepare myself for the possibility or the likelihood that I won't win. I don't know if I'll win. As I mentioned yesterday, I feel like I already have, because I've learned so much and enjoyed so much, many of the experiences I've had in the campaign. But at the same time, I care so very much about the issues that I really would like to win. But on the other hand, it's out of my control. And I need to be prepared for the fact that that I really don't have any control over it. So be that as it may, I've found that I'm having some strange psychological feelings today. It's been a strange day. My wife asked me if I was all right, because she said we chatted on the phone earlier today. She said that I sounded a little bit down, and I guess maybe I did, and maybe I am, but I can't really pinpoint why. I just am. Maybe it's just, maybe it's the beginning of just a sigh. A psychological sigh, knowing that the whole thing is coming to an end. It seemed like it had been going on for so long. I don't know what it is. But anyway, one of the reasons that I was looking forward to today's program was that I really believe that some of the materials that we've been dealing with, some of the issues that we dealt with yesterday and we'll be dealing with today, are the best medicine in the world. For if you're feeling it all down, sometimes you can become so excited and get engaged so intricately with some of this material. At least I can. I found that yesterday. For those of you who were kind enough to tune into yesterday's program, especially in the second hour when we were dealing with the issue of representation, as I look back on the hour when it ended, I thought, my Lord, that was so much more emotional than I expected it to be. I didn't really anticipate becoming that emotional on this particular issue. It's kind of interesting, because the topic was representation. And the idea of representation is seemingly one of the most mundane, to many people, boring issues, but in reality it's not. It is vital to the operation of our whole system, and that was really the issue that I was trying to get across yesterday. What makes our political system unique, what makes our system work, is the system of representation. And when anything is done to jeopardize, interfere with, or detract from the nature of representation itself, it has a direct impact, a direct effect on the operation and the strength of our political system. The ability of the constituents, of people, citizens, to participate actively in the political system which makes the rules by which all of us agree to live depends directly on the strength and the caliber of representation. Madison knew that, and he emphasized in the Federalist Papers related to representation and to the legislative branch of government, he emphasized this particular issue over and over again, that ultimately, if participatory government is going to work, if people really believe that their word, their opinions matter, their voice matters, and that they are being not only given the opportunity to speak, but being given the opportunity to be listened to seriously, taken seriously, then our political system is strong. But if people ever get the feeling that that's not true, and that this is rather a the participatory government in this nation is really a sham, that certain people's opinions matter much more than theirs, I think that's probably the concern that worries me the most. That concerns about big money in our electoral process, the ability of big money and campaign funding to buy votes and buy loyalty, really does jeopardize the functioning of our entire political system. It's very, very serious, and it's very, very real. I mentioned that the reason I got into this is not only because of this particular program. It's one of the major issues associated with understanding the Constitution of the United States. So therefore, it needs to be obviously considered in a program like this. But the fact of the matter is, I've seen real examples right here where I live, that the system of representation is not functioning the way it was intended to function. But at the same time, the word representation is being used. The fact of the matter is, the guts of representation, the substance, the meat, if you will, of representative government is not really operative at all. That most of the involvement of constituents in political decision-making, I'm finding, occurs after the fact. That the major issues and the opinions that go into the decisions are being made not by constituents, but by other people, many of them out-of-state special interests, heavy hitters financially, those people that are able to buy influence, all of the things that really jeopardize the credibility of our political system. And that's what we got into yesterday. So naturally, and again, I say this naturally, but I think it's important to say, the way I feel about this political system, the way I feel about the Constitution and the contributions of the founders, their vision, their ideals, their principles, their hopes for the future, all of those things, all of that together means that any kind of negative tampering with the operation of this system that jeopardizes its effectiveness really does bother me. And I get emotional about it, and I did yesterday, I guess. So if that bothered some folks, I apologize for that. But on the other hand, I think a certain amount of emotion is necessary in order to make the issue real, in order to try to explain the seriousness of the issue. And that's a little bit difficult, as I say, with something like representation. Because on its surface, at least, it doesn't appear to be an issue that one could become emotional about. But if you feel very strongly about this political system, then you have to feel very strongly about the kinds of things that are happening in the area of representation. And what I felt good about in terms of yesterday's program was the substantive evidence that we were able to bring to the table to support this point of view. The speech, the 1774 speech of Edmund Burke to the electors in England on the nature of representation and on the ultimate responsibility of the representatives to make the final decisions. I think that's very important, because if you read this, you begin to understand not only the importance of the role in representative government that constituents, that citizens bring to the table, but you also begin to understand the nature of the responsibility of the elected representative. And indeed, it does matter that the representative is expected to have the wisdom and the commitment and the good judgment to make the right decision after all the evidence is collected. And for that evidence, you have to have constituent input. If you're getting your input from somewhere else other than your constituents, then representation, as it was designed to function, is not happening. It may be communication with the voters, as I mentioned yesterday, but it's after the fact communication, not before the fact. In order for representation to work, citizens must have input. Citizens must have the opportunity to be heard while the decisions are being debated, not only after they are made. Edmund Burke, I didn't read this yesterday, but on second thought, I kind of thought maybe today at the beginning of our program and reviewing some of the things from yesterday that it might be worthwhile to share this paragraph with you. Remember yesterday I talked about, I did share with you the Edmund Burke paragraph about the importance of constituents and the responsibility of the elected representative to be in constant, unreserved communication with his constituents, that their wishes ought to have great weight with him, their opinion, high respect, their business, unremitted attention. It is the duty of the representative to sacrifice his repose, his pleasures, his satisfactions to theirs. And above all, ever, and in all cases, to prefer their interest to his own. The right of constituents to be heard on the issues which affect them is not merely a luxury that our government benefits from. It is an absolutely critical necessity if our representative government is to work. But, says Edmund Burke, it is the representative's unbiased opinion, his mature judgment, his enlightened conscience that must ultimately make the decision. He ought not, Burke says, to sacrifice these things to the constituents, to any group of people. The reason that he is elected is because he brings this judgment, this fairness, this experience, this wisdom to the table. The electors, the voters, have chosen him because they feel that this representative has the wisdom and the judgment and the fairness and the experience to make the right decision for them. If the representative doesn't do that, but instead defers to the constituents, he may think that he's doing his constituents a favor. In reality, Burke said, he's shortchanging those who voted for him. He is denying them the benefit of his talents and his abilities. Burke says the following. My worthy colleague, he said, and this is, of course, in the speech to the electors of Bristol. What that means is the electors of Bristol are the voters. And Burke obviously has an opponent. And Burke says, my worthy colleague says, his will ought to be subservient to yours. If that be all, Burke says, the thing is innocent. If government were a matter of will upon any side, yours, without question, ought to be superior. In other words, as far as it goes, he's saying, my colleague is right. The will of the people ought to take precedence. Yes. But, he says, government and legislation are matters of reason and judgment, not of inclination. And what sort of reason is that in which the determination precedes the discussion, in which one set of men deliberate and another decides, where those who form the conclusion are perhaps 300 miles away from those who hear the arguments? And that 300 miles away is the issue of special interests who are not directly involved in this particular constituency at all, but whose point of view prevails because they have influence, power, and money. And Burke says, if you do that, if you defer to these people, you're going to make the wrong decisions. The decisions aren't going to be the right ones. They aren't going to involve the people that they should involve. And instead, they're going to involve people who have no business putting in their 2 cents worth at all in the first place. Burke says, to deliver an opinion is the right of all men. That of constituents is weighty and is a weighty and respectable opinion, which a representative ought always to rejoice to hear, and which he ought always most seriously to consider. But, Burke says, authoritative instructions, mandates issued, which the member is bound blindly and implicitly to obey, to vote and to argue for, though contrary to the clearest conviction of his judgment and conscience, these are things utterly unknown to the laws of this land, and which arise from a fundamental mistake of the whole order and tenor of our Constitution. Ultimately, it is the responsibility of the representative to hear constituents, to collect the evidence, to engage the constituents in discussion in an educational process. And then when all the information is on the table, it's up to the representative to make the final decision. That's why he was elected. And to surrender that decision-making power to somebody else violates the very nature of government, of representative government. I don't think one could find a clearer picture of the nature of representation than that speech. The founders, to a man, bought into it, did not challenge it. That ultimately is the basis of the system. It's what representative government is all about. It's what Republican government is all about. That's what these terms mean. And I think that was my concern in yesterday's program, was the fact that we see so many examples where this system is being perverted. And then you'll recall yesterday we looked at Madison's Federalist Number 39. When Madison gets into the characteristics of Republican government, and ultimately his basic position is that when you basically peel away all the rhetoric The nature of representative government, of republicanism, is a government which derives all of its powers directly or indirectly from the great body of the people. Not by a small group of that body, but the whole body of the people. That's what makes the decisions legitimate. That's what binds citizens to live with the results. So, for example, the debate that was that occurred so openly a few weeks ago about whether Donald Trump would accept the legitimacy of the vote today if he loses. And Trump's response that he'll make that decision at the time. If it's fair, he says, he'll accept it. And you know he made the facetious comment at a rally during this conversation that he committed to accept the will of the voters if he wins. Ultimately, the process determines the legitimacy and the validity of the result. It is not the result that determines whether representative government's working or not. It's the process. The assumption is if the process is working as it was designed to work, then everybody engaged in the discussion is committed to accepting the results. When you vote, you are in fact doing that. You are psychologically affirming the results of the election, whether you win it or whether you lose it. That's why it is so important that people vote. Because in order for people to be held accountable for the rules, the policies, and the laws under which they live in a Republican form of government, they need to have had the opportunity to have their say in the making of those rules. Otherwise, the rules are purely arbitrary. And the only way to get people to abide by them is to force people to abide by them. The fact of the matter is, what makes representative government work is that people willingly support laws which they feel they have had a say in making. And I think anybody who's ever been in management knows this. That if those you supervise feel that they have had an opportunity to be heard in the process of formulating the rules, then it's much easier to enforce those rules. And I think that's the issue that we were dealing with yesterday. So that was, for all practical purposes, the second hour of yesterday's program. And I mentioned that we would be getting into an article which appeared in the New Yorker by George Packer, dated October 31st, entitled "Hillary Clinton and the Populist Revolt: The Democrats Lost the White Working Class, the Republicans Exploited It, Can Clinton Win It Back?" Basically, what George Packer does in this very extensive article, it prints out to 20 pages, I might tell you. It's that long. It's well worth a read. I believe that it's one of the most informative pieces about contemporary politics, political realities in our society today that I've ever read anywhere. There's a lot of information here. A lot of insight. George Packer is able to make a number of very creative, insightful connections to some of the books coming out, some of the most recent stories and bestsellers coming out and why they are what they are. He has an absolutely brilliant passage on the musical Hamilton and what not only what is making that musical so popular with audiences, but what that particular musical says about the political realities of the society in which we live. Who likes it and who doesn't and why? Packer believes that the popularity of the Hamilton musical is tied to directly to the nature of the political system we live in today's 21st century America. That its popularity appeals, that musical appeals to the priorities of today's professional elites. Those people who believe that the biggest issues that society faces today are issues of class and gender and race and equality and all the rest of it. For those people who see those issues as priorities, the musical Hamilton speaks their language. Non-whites play the roles of the founding fathers. For example, Jefferson is portrayed in that musical by an African American. And it speaks to the very nature of the kind of world we're living in. It also speaks to the political realities of those people who are struggling so hard to stop the kinds of change that are taking over their world, they feel. Those for whom Donald Trump claims to be their voice. Those who up till this campaign have really had no voice. They are unorganized. Their interests don't represent the priorities of the Republican Party, nor do they represent the priorities of the Democratic Party anymore. And there are tens of millions of these people. Witness the strength of the support being generated to the candidacy of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is speaking to and for tens of millions of disaffected, unemployed or underemployed, non-highly educated, desperate, disaffected, frustrated, angry Americans. These are the people who feel that they are the victims of the changes taking place in the world around them. They see the influx of these changes as being directly threatening to them. They are wont to accept the fact that there seems to be some sort of a conspiracy that is being perpetrated at their expense, and nobody seems willing to listen to them until now. And now they seem to have found somebody who hears them and who is committed to articulating their concerns and their priority. Someone who claims to be able to and willing to be their voice. And they are flocking to his support. The fact that he's guilty of saying bad things, that he's insulting minorities and disabled people and other religions and other races and other nationalities and other countries and all the rest of it, meaningless to these people when weighed against the fact that finally somebody seems to be hearing them. The challenge, if Hillary Clinton does win today's election, her principal challenge is going to be to address the concerns of these people who didn't vote for her. These are people who used to be the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. But somehow, they've been allowed to slip through the cracks. They've lost the support of the Democratic leadership. And they have seen themselves as desperately searching for somebody who will listen to them. Donald Trump is speaking their language. And this election today does not end the issue. It merely begins it. It is clearly one of the principal challenges that the next president of the United States faces, to find a way to reintegrate these people into the mainstream of society. Because to allow that many people to feel that frustrated, that disaffected, that angry, is to jeopardize the harmony, peace, and economic development of the entire nation. We can't continue to go forward as if these people didn't exist. The campaign of Donald Trump and the success that campaign has experienced is proof positive that these people do matter and that they will continue to matter. And we better start to take them seriously. Because everything we've done here at the Virtual Center to understand the nature of this political system is based on the principal realities of inclusion. The whole flow of events through the history of this nation has been focused on the idea of finding ways to include the unexcluded, the unincluded, the excluded, into the mainstream of society. And here, suddenly, we realize that there are tens of millions of people who have been abandoned, or feel that they have been abandoned, by this political system. The challenge is huge. It's going to be one that the next president of the United States, whichever candidate wins, is going to have to take on, and it's not going to be easy. Because basically you're going to have to win back the loyalty and the support of these people. That's really an overview of this particular article by George Packer. It's well worth reading. It's well worth discussing. There's quite a bit in it. I believe there's something in it for all of us. With that, then, I'd like to begin to address some of the substance of this particular article. At the very beginning of the article, I think there is substantive information there that, for whatever reason, has really not drawn the kind of attention that it should have. Let me explain exactly what I mean. Packer begins his article by sharing a conversation that he had with Hillary Clinton in the basement of a hotel on Capitol Hill. And he points out that the two of them are sitting there alone. And basically, Packer is raising questions with Hillary about the nature of this political campaign. He said, "I sat down across from her. With only a few weeks left until the election, I wanted to ask her about the voters she's had the most trouble winning. Why were so many downwardly mobile white Americans supporting Donald Trump?" This is an interview that just happened a few weeks ago. The article was published in the New Yorker on the 31st of October. The research for it was done in the weeks just prior to that. So we're talking about research that's not even a month old. This conversation between George Packer and Hillary Clinton is weeks old, not months old. And basically his question to her is, why is it that so many downwardly mobile white Americans are supporting Donald Trump? And this is the quote from Hillary Clinton. This is her answer to that question. "It's pox on both your houses," Clinton said. Quote, "It was certainly a rejection of every other Republican running. So pick the guy who's the outsider. Pick the guy who's giving you an explanation. In my view, a trumped up one, not convincing, but nevertheless, people are hungry for that," unquote. So what Hillary is saying is the reason Trump was able to attract this particular group is because these people were so hungry for somebody to hear them, somebody to listen to them, somebody willing to articulate their anger and their frustration. As Hillary said, they needed some kind of narrative to explain what was happening to them. They couldn't just accept it as inevitable. There had to be a reason. There's got to be some reason why this is happening to us. Therefore, they were ripe for any explanation that seemed sensible. And Donald Trump gave it to them. Hillary believes that the reason Trump was able to attract these voters, these people, is because these people were hungry for somebody who would help them understand what was happening to them, to be able to articulate a narrative which made sense to them. Donald Trump, she says, came up with a fairly simple, easily understood, and to some extent satisfying story. And I think we Democrats have not provided as clear a message about how we see the economy as we need to, she said. We need to get back to claiming the economic mantle. That we are the ones who create the jobs, who provide the support that's needed to get more fairness into the economy, unquote. Hillary Clinton, right here, is explaining how she believes the Democrats have dropped the ball. We Democrats, she says, have not provided as clear a message about how we see the economy as we need to. We've not talked to these people. We've ignored them. We've pretended that they weren't even there. We never even acknowledged their existence, let alone address their concerns. We need to get back, she says, to claiming the economic mantle. We're the ones who create jobs. We're the ones who make the economy fair. We're the ones that people need to support in order to know that they're being treated equitably in this competitive economic situation. So what Hillary is saying here in private, she doesn't seem able to say in public. That's why I find this so incredibly informative. Bernie Sanders did speak to these people. Bernie Sanders articulated a vision of reintegrating these people into the Democratic Party, or more particularly, of making the kinds of reforms in the Democratic Party necessary to win back the support of these people. Hillary is now acknowledging that. She is now admitting that the Democratic Party dropped the ball here. She is, I think, in effect admitting that Bernie Sanders was onto something. He clearly was onto something. So is Donald Trump. The difference was that Bernie Sanders recognized that it's the Democratic Party that dropped the ball here, and it's the Democratic Party that had to revisit its own mission and get back to the business that has made the Democratic Party the Democratic Party. Some weeks ago here at the Virtual Center, you'll recall, we had a program on the platform of the Democratic Party here in West Virginia. And incidentally, we talked a little bit about the platform of the National Democratic Party that was hammered out just prior to the Democratic Convention. All of us know, I'm sure, that the Bernie Sanders people were pretty much given the power to write the Democratic platform in Philadelphia. This was a major concession that Hillary was willing to make in order to ensure the support of those who were supporting Bernie Sanders for her candidacy. She had to be willing to buy in to many of the positions that Bernie Sanders was articulating, and she did that. Here in West Virginia, my concern with the state Democratic Party here in West Virginia is that the leadership of that party has not done that. The leadership of that party has not really bought into its own platform at all. In fact, today's election day, the entire campaign has been conducted in West Virginia with barely a mention of the platform. It is a Bernie Sanders-inspired platform. It is a people-focused platform. It basically redefines the role of the Democratic Party in terms of its ability to address the needs and concerns of people, not companies, not bottom lines, not Dow Jones averages, not Standard & Poor's, not the International Monetary Fund, not the nature of worldwide commerce. No, what it does address is the mission of the Democratic Party to serve the needs of people. and the Democratic Party leadership can't endorse or embody or embrace that platform, it better. That's the message that Hillary Clinton's giving us in this particular quote. What she's basically saying to George Packer here is, if I'm elected, I know what we did wrong. I know what we didn't do. I know what we need to do, and we will get about doing it. And all I can say is, she better. Because if she doesn't, then what we've called Trumpism will continue to haunt her administration, presuming that there indeed will be a Clinton administration, assuming that she will indeed win today's election. Packer says, quote, Clinton has given a lot of thought to economic policy. She wants to use tax incentives and other enticements to nudge corporations into focusing less on share price and more on long-term investments in research, equipment, and workers. Period. I want to stop. I want to focus on that particular sentence. Hillary Clinton wants to use tax incentives and other enticements to nudge corporations into focusing less on share price and more on long-term investments in research, equipment, and workers. That sentence identifies the basis of the issue. It identifies the basis of the reason that so many downwardly mobile white working people, predominantly males, have flocked to the candidacy of Donald Trump. Basically, what she's criticizing in this particular statement is the shift in corporate priorities from reinvestment back of profit back into the economy in favor of exploding or upping the stock prices, the value of the company's stock. In other words, what she is doing is raising questions about corporate decisions to make the priorities of the shareholders the most important factor in what the corporation does in the economy. She is criticizing a major piece of the new capitalism. The idea being that what corporations have done is stop reinvesting profit back into the enterprise in order to create more jobs, in order to continue to stimulate economic growth. Instead, corporations have been inclined to take profit out of the enterprise, out of the business, and use it to reward stockholders. And so the fact of the matter is, the value of the Dow Jones has gone up and up and up as owners of large blocks of stock in major corporations have been doing very well over the last 15 to 20 years. But worker salaries have not gone up at all. Jobs have become less and less plentiful. And the skill demands to get those jobs have become more and more severe. In this one sentence, Hillary Clinton is acknowledging a major solution, I believe, to the issues. Let me raise one question or one concern, however. And that is the following. That Hillary wants to use tax incentives and other enticements in order to nudge corporations into doing this. She wants to make it profitable for companies to do what they should have been doing all along, rather than make them do it. Rather than use the executive power of government to expose corporate behavior to more rigid, demanding regulation and guidance. Basically, what she's talking about is using the profit motive, the incentive of profit, which these corporations, they know all about that. Use that to encourage corporations to do the right thing and to once again be willing to invest in jobs, in equipment, in research, and in workers. I'm thinking of the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. More specifically, I'm thinking to President Obama's determination and decision to make the Affordable Care Act attractive to the private sector. By making this a boondoggle for insurance companies. In effect, what Obama was trying to do with the Affordable Care Act, I believe, was to walk a fine line between expanding access to health care for millions of people who didn't have it and doing it in ways that enabled insurance companies to make substantial profits in the process. He was trying to reward both sides. And as we know, it backfired. Basically, what we're confronted with now is a situation where it looks like the insurance rates are going to skyrocket after the first of the year because so many companies have pulled out of the exchanges, which means there's less competition for business, which means the rates go up. And some people believe that it might actually jeopardize the Affordable Care Act. Clearly, it needs revision. It needs fixing. But President Obama has been hesitant because you don't let the enemies of the tax of the healthcare program fix it. You've got to somehow leave the fixing to people who support the idea of the Affordable Care Act, who accept the fact and support the idea of making health care available to millions of people who didn't have it. But in the process, whatever he did had to be profit-making for the private sector, in this case, the insurance companies. He believed then that he was buying the loyalty of the insurance industry because of the profits they would make, because of all the new policies they would write under the Affordable Care Act. In a sense, President Obama was so consciously trying to create the Affordable Care Act in such a way that it appealed to the private sector as well as to the people in need of healthcare services. That he was using profit in order to incentivize, in order to nudge the private sector into supporting the Affordable Care Act. And it now begins to look like the private sector is stabbing him in the back. Many people believed that what was needed in healthcare was universal healthcare. Medicare for everybody, where the medical bills were sent directly to the government. There was no private insurance, no insurance companies making humongous profits at all. That socialized medicine, that the private sector was up in arms about. That controversy is what Obama was trying to avoid. So the fact of the matter is, he did everything he could do to compromise with the private sector. And it looks like they're going to cross him. It kind of goes back to the Booker T. Washington Atlanta Compromise speech we looked at a few weeks ago on the issues of the ex-slave and the economic development of the South. Washington believed that if you make the case to business that if you include the ex-slaves in the economic opportunities, in the jobs being generated in the economic growth of the South, then the potential of the South is unlimited. But if you don't, we'll be a drag on the economy, on the potential of the new South. He really believed that that profit motive alone would be enough to nudge the private sector in the post-Civil War South to make opportunities available to the ex-slaves. Obviously, it didn't work. Racial considerations outweighed the profit motive. And corporations began to move rapidly in the direction of segregation. And the result was that they accepted a less than vibrant economic development for the New South in exchange for the right to continue to control the race issue in the South. So incentivizing the private sector didn't work for Booker T. Washington. It didn't work for Obama. Will it work for Hillary Clinton? The difference between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton is that Bernie Sanders was more willing to use government to force the private sector to do what it needed to do. Hillary believes that she can work with them, that she can nudge them, incentivize them with the attraction of additional profit to redirect their investments from shareholders' profits into expanding jobs, equipment, and opportunity for the many. I guess the debate, the question that I'm raising, is whether, in fact, she's being somewhat naive. It didn't work for Obama. It didn't work for Booker T. Washington. Yet somehow she believes that she can get the same corporations that she's earned the speaking fees from to do the right thing by making profit available. I don't know whether it's going to work or not. What George Packer says, however, during this interview is that as he continued to quote Hillary Clinton, her ideas became more and more clear. "I want to really marry the public and private sector," she said. She thinks that a working relationship between the public sector and the private sector will solve the problem. The question is, will it? Or does the private sector need to be forced to do what it needs to do in the public interest? Because the reality is that the tremendous power of support that Donald Trump is getting is testimony to the power and the threat of obstruction and potential violence in our society if we don't address this problem successfully. In the face of the problem this serious, is incentivizing enough? I think that's the question. I think that's the question that Hillary's going to have to confront. And the fact of the matter is, Hillary is one of them, so to speak. She has much more going on the side of the private sector, of big money, than she does a shrinking white working class. And it's kind of hard, and I think George Packer makes this point in his article. It's kind of hard to call these people white working class when there aren't any jobs. Most of them are white, yes. But after World War II, the tremendous industrial expansion after World War II convinced many of these people that they were middle class. They were able to buy private homes in the suburbs. They were able to drive new cars and began to live a middle class lifestyle. That's what's gone. That's what's been taken away. So I don't know whether it's worth, whether it's accurate to call these people the white working class or not. It's a white class that's not working. That's part of the problem. And given the seriousness of it, and given the threat that Donald Trump's campaign has made clear to the nation as a whole, one has to wonder whether incentivizing the private sector with profit is enough. If the problem is as serious as it appears to be, then the next president's probably going to have to do a lot more than incentivize and nudge. If you think back to the New Deal, FDR had an incredibly challenging problem trying to convince the business community in the 1930s of the need for the new, for the kind of legislation that becomes the New Deal. Because it violated everything these people believed in. So I think this problem is really very serious. I think George Packer's article does so much, at least in my mind, to clarify the nature of that problem. Let me go on and finish and share with you the rest of this interview with Hillary Clinton, because I think it's incredibly important and insightful. She says, and this is Hillary speaking, in her speech at the Philadelphia Convention, she said, quote, "Americans are willing to work and work hard. But right now, an awful lot of people feel there's less and less respect for the work they do and less respect for them, period. Democrats, we are the party of working people. But we haven't done a good enough job showing we get what you're going through. In other words, we have allowed these people to abandon the Democratic Party because we abandoned them." Bernie Sanders' campaign seems to me to have been based on the reality of that abandonment, on the responsibility of the Democratic Party to make the kinds of reforms which will bring back these people that we allowed to leave. Now here's Hillary Clinton, 2 weeks before the election, admitting in a private interview that this is what she believes the Democratic Party has to do. The most encouraging thing about this, I believe, is that Hillary Clinton is willing to put the burden of proof of responsibility on the Democratic Party, not on the working class, not on the people who are disaffected, but on the fact that the Democratic Party ceased to represent them, ceased to care about them, and allowed them to become invisible. And in effect, allowed them to be taken over by the Republicans, by a demagogue like Donald Trump, who came along, could speak their language, and was able to tap into the anger and the disaffection. I think the most encouraging thing here is that Hillary Clinton is willing to put the responsibility on the Democratic Party, which to me suggests an agenda for her administration should she win. It's, as I read this, it might be the most encouraging thing that I've seen in this whole campaign is a plan, a way to address. I mean, how many times people have asked me, it's one thing to define the problem. How do you fix it? How do you go about fixing it? That's the challenge. It seems to me she's aware of the challenge and also aware of where you need to go to fix it. I find this extremely encouraging. She goes on. We have been fighting out elections in general on a lot of non-economic issues over the past 30 years, she said. Social issues, welfare, crime, war, drugs. Quote, sometimes we win, sometimes we lose, but we haven't had a coherent, compelling economic case that needs to be made in order to lay down a foundation on which to both conduct politics and do policy. What we have allowed ourselves to do is to drift into the social issues and abandon the economic soul, which has been what the Democratic Party has been about for close to the last century. And in the process, we abandon the very people who were the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. We became more Republican than Democrat. And that takes me back to the politics here in West Virginia and the number of party switches that I mentioned, that I've mentioned before. That when you look back historically here in West Virginia, the Democratic Party here would be Republican anywhere else, because it was being driven by the priorities of the private sector, more specifically coal. Coal was defining, was giving government the marching orders. It didn't matter which party was in power, because in reality, neither one of them were. Coal was. And basically, political parties in West Virginia bought into that reality. They permitted or allowed themselves to do the bidding of the private sector. And now they're paying the price for it. Hillary Clinton is suggesting that the same thing happened on the national level. The Democratic Party pretty much abandoned the principles on which it was built and abandoned the people for whom the Democratic Party was their only viable answer. It rendered them helpless and vulnerable and made them allowed them to be susceptible to Republican takeover. They lost it. And George Packer's argument is, can Hillary win it back? The question, it seems to me, is an important one. The idea that Hillary's plans are pretty much to marry the public sector and the private sector, find ways to accomplish what she needs to accomplish, and at the same time, do it in a way which allows the private sector to continue to reap, to make profit, seems to me to be very ideal, very idealistic. I don't think Bernie Sanders was quite so idealistic. I think that's the major difference between the two. I think Bernie was much more inclined, much more willing to accept the fact that government was going to have to begin to define much more precisely what the private sector was going to have to do in order to accomplish what needed to be accomplished, rather than just make it profitable enough for them to do it. Packer points out that in the 90s, in the 1990s, under President Bill Clinton, if you remember, Bill Clinton was talking all the time about a bridge to the 21st century. Globalization was that bridge. International trade agreements, the first one being NAFTA, was the way to navigate your way across that bridge. Bill Clinton believed that the combination of world trade and technological advance, the internet, was the future. That the global commercial network, worldwide trade network, that globalization represented was what he called the bridge to the 21st century. In reality, what he did was leave it up to people, to individual people, to find their place in the line marching across that bridge. Too many people weren't able to make it onto the bridge. Too many people weren't able to master the technology. Too many people weren't educated sufficiently to be able to master the challenges of the information revolution. Too many people were being left behind. But in tandem with a new professional elite of engineers, programmers, and all the ancillary positions associated with the communication revolution, the Democratic Party marched across the bridge to the 21st century and led this new class of professionals with them. That became the heart and soul of the constituency which made up the Democratic Party from the 90s until now. The working class, those who had made up the heart and soul of the Democratic Party through the 20th century, were abandoned. They never made it onto the bridge. The educational reforms never happened for the many. There was economic opportunity for the few. They made it. And the Democratic Party began to represent the interests of this new professional elite. So what you had, according to George Packer, was a situation where the Republican Party continued to represent the interests of the private sector, the interests of corporate America. The Democratic Party began to reflect and represent the interests of this new professional class. Nobody was speaking for the working class, for the people who were being displaced by globalization. As the jobs began to leave the country and move overseas, as corporate executives continued to try to find the places where they could get the cheapest labor and were making the moves appropriate to the pursuit of those objectives, of those profit objectives, tens of millions of working people were being displaced, were being left behind. Nobody was speaking for them. Nobody was representing them. They were losing their jobs. They were being forced to take jobs which paid substantially less. They were losing quality of lifestyle. All the things that they believed were theirs were being taken away from them. And nobody seemed willing or able to hear them or represent them or speak for them or do anything to help them. This is the group. This is the constituency that has made Donald Trump a candidate for president of the United States. This is the constituency that the Democratic Party has lost and must get back. If Hillary Clinton is lucky enough to win this election, that is going to be, that has to be, her number one priority. Because Trumpism is not going away. That problem is not going away. It will continue to obstruct her administration. It will affect her policy making. It will affect her ability to govern. It's a problem that she has no other alternative except to address successfully. I truly believe this. I think this is what this election is about. This is a final quote from Hillary Clinton. "I think we haven't organized ourselves for the 21st century globalization," she said. America, she believes, had wrongly ceded manufacturing to other countries and allowed trade deals to hurt our workers. We jumped on the globalization bandwagon and opened up all sorts of possibilities for the professionally talented, for the computer geeks, for the people that could take advantage of it. But for the vast majority of people who couldn't, there was nothing. We plunged forward with globalization. We allowed our businesses to go overseas. We caused tens of millions of people to lose their jobs. We allowed most of our major cities to shrink into destitution and crime and drugs. We abandoned our workers. And the two major parties began to represent the well-to-do interests in society. Nobody was representing the interests of the working poor. I think that that is one hell of a scenario. I recommend this article very, very strongly to you. We're at the end of our program today. It's 59 minutes after the hour. We've got to begin to move out. I don't think we're going to be doing a program tomorrow, a live program. I have to go out and pick up my campaign signs. From what I understand, they want them picked up by Friday of this week. So I'm going to drive tomorrow throughout my district and just pick up every sign that I can lay my hands on and hope that that'll be successful. So the next live program we have here at the Virtual Center will be in this coming Monday. I hope you have a wonderful rest of the week. I want to thank you so very much for tuning in. I want to thank you for just giving me the opportunity to be here at the Virtual Center. I do hope that you have a wonderful week, and I thank you. Bye-bye.